The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com, and that is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. The issue I'll be reading today is again the one dated April 26/May 3, 2021. I am, in fact, reading it on this third day of May. Climate is everything. How the pandemic can lead us to a better, greener world. By Justin Warland. And the cover photo, as I've described before, is by Luca Locatelli. The artwork by Red Hong Yi and Annis Lin. It is a depiction in two dimensions of the continents of the world ablaze. The continents are created out of 50,000 matchsticks to represent how the climate crisis connects us all. These burning continents are implanted on a light pale blue-gray background, perhaps to depict the seas. Time, the word, is in white large block letters. Climate is everything is in not quite so large white black letters. And the border, as usual on the front cover, is in red. Climate is everything. As the world emerges from COVID-19 pandemic, it is becoming clear in every aspect of what comes next, how we plan, build, sell, educate, legislate, move, create. The shared ingredient is addressing climate change. Force of nature, the pandemic remade the economy. Now, it is the climate's turn. This is by Justin Warland. Photographs are by Thomas Pryor. The first photograph looks like a piece of colorful stained glass. It's in a grid pattern, going from pale blue greens into blues into pale yellow, deeper yellow, gold, orange, and finally at the bottom, a bright orange red. I thought maybe it was a stained glass window. It would be very attractive with the light filtering through. According to the caption, it is an office park on the outskirts of Austin. On her third day as the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Marcia Fudge phoned the White House. She had taken over an agency with a role to play addressing a range of crises as the lack of affordable housing in U.S. cities has left hundreds of thousands homeless and millions more in financial straits. She connected with Joe Biden's climate team. Fudge and Gina McCarthy, Biden's national climate advisor, talked about addressing climate change and the affordable housing shortage at the same time. 3 weeks later, the administration announced plans to provide for more than 1 million resilient and energy-efficient housing units. People are actually from every agency knocking on our doors, says McCarthy, wondering how they can be part of what is essentially a hopeful future. From her perch in the West Wing, McCarthy has been charged by Biden with overseeing a dramatic shift in the way the U.S. pursues action on climate change. Instead of turning to a select few environment-focused agencies to make climate policy, McCarthy and her office are working to infuse climate considerations into everything the administration does. The task force she runs includes everyone from Secretary of Defense, who's evaluating the climate threat to national security, to the Treasury Secretary, who's working to stem the risk that climate change poses to the financial system. The approach affords us the opportunity to be more than greenhouse gas accountants, says Ali Zaidi, McCarthy's deputy. We can tackle the breadth of the climate challenge and the opportunity if we map the intersections with housing policy and the intersection with racial justice and the intersection with public health. For decades, the idea that climate change touches everything has grown behind the scenes. Leaders from small island countries have pleaded with the rest of the world to notice how climate change has begun to uproot their lives in areas from health care to schooling. Social scientists have crunched the data, illuminating how climate change will ripple across society, contributing to a surge in migration, reduced productivity, and a spike in crime. And advocates and thinkers have proposed everything from a conscious move to economic degrowth to eco-capitalism to make climate the government's driving force. Now, spurred by alarming science, growing public fury, and a deadly pandemic, government officials, corporate bosses, and civil society leaders are finally waking up to a simple idea whose time has come. Climate is everything. It is out of this recognition that the EU has allocated hundreds of billions of euros to put climate at the center of its economic plans. Seemingly unrelated activist groups have embraced environmental goals, and investors have flooded firms advancing the energy transition with trillions of dollars. The world's crossing the long-awaited political tipping point on climate right now, says Al Gore, a former U.S. vice president who won the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize for his climate activism. We are seeing the beginning of a new era. The course of climatization, the process by which climate change will transform society, will play out in the coming years in every corner of society. Whether it leads to a more resilient world or exacerbates the worst elements of our society depends on whether we adjust or just stumble through. We are at the point where climate change means systems change, and almost every system will change, says Rachel Kite, dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University and a longtime climate leader. That understanding is long overdue, but I do not think we know exactly what it means yet. It is a moment of maximum hope. It is also a moment of high risk. The basis for human civilization was laid roughly 10,000 years ago, when after tens of thousands of years of unpredictable weather, the Earth's climate stabilized. Weather extremes became more manageable. Humans began to practice agriculture. The global population grew from fewer than 10 million people 10,000 years ago to more than 7.7 billion today. We have a buzzing global economy measured in dollars and cents, but our economic system has failed to account for the role a stable climate played in creating it. For decades, scientists, activists, and economists have warned of growth without concern for the consequences. Simon Kuznets, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who conceptualized GDP warned in the 1960s that distinctions must be kept in mind between quantity and quality of growth, between its costs and return. Gore cautioned in his 1992 book, Earth in the Balance, that humans need to make the rescue of the environment the central organizing principle for civilization, or risk losing everything. And in 2006, the Stern Review, that's STERN, a groundbreaking report from a group headed by former World Bank chief economist Nicholas Stern, found that climate change could drive a 20% decline in global GDP. Still, climate change remained a marginal concern for most. Over the past 3 years, that's begun to change, at first slowly and then suddenly. In 2018, the UN climate science body published a landmark and chilling report of a looming catastrophe if the world did not accelerate the pivot to a low-carbon economy. Protesters took to the streets around the globe. First in Sweden and then on the global stage, Greta Thunberg decried the pursuit of growth without concern for the environmental consequences. In the U.S., the Sunrise Movement, a youth activist group, called for a Green New Deal that would put climate at the center of the American economy, melding action on climate change with progressive priorities. When COVID-19 hit, the climate conversation at first took a back seat as hospital beds filled. But in the midst of the crisis, interest seemed only to grow as the pandemic reminded people of the risk of ignoring science and the world's interconnectedness. Ahead of the U.S. presidential election, polls showed American voters more concerned about climate change than ever before. And as the pandemic devastated economies, leaders around the world promised to rebuild with climate change in mind. People are suddenly reflecting what kind of society, what kind of world, what kind of economy are we living in, says Achim Steiner, head of the UN Development Program. Climate change suddenly has become a vehicle of green recovery. Many countries have yet to match the rhetoric with action. A February report from the UN found that emissions would decline just 1% by 2030 with nations' commitments, though that estimate notably did not include countries like the U.S. that had yet to share their plans. But the understanding that halting warming will require considering climate across the economy is now all but universally accepted on the global stage. Unthinkable. Just a couple of years ago, political leaders have bet their country's economic futures on climate-fighting measures. Action on climate is not only necessary for the future of our lives and livelihoods, says Stern. Climate action is the main engine of growth. It is the growth story of the 21st century. There is no doubt that the sharpest turnaround is in the U.S., where a president who denied climate change was replaced by one who's made it an organizing principle of economic policy. The Biden administration's proposed $2.65 trillion infrastructure package, intended to lift the U.S. out of its COVID-driven recession, calls for $174 billion to win the electric vehicle market, $35 billion for climate-related research and development, and $100 billion to advance clean energy on the electric grid. Even aspects of the plan that seem unrelated to climate, roads and bridges, housing and broadband, have a climate angle. Transportation infrastructure will be built with resilience to climate risks. New affordable housing will be energy efficient, and broadband will aid low-carbon industries. More than half the spending is clean and climate-friendly, according to a World Resources Institute analysis. Crucially, a slew of initiatives, apart from the infrastructure package, seek to address the economic costs of climate change. Flood insurance premiums are set to rise to reflect flood vulnerability. Financial regulators have begun pushing new rules to require companies to disclose climate risk. In a far-reaching move, the administration is calculating a new figure to represent the economic cost of each ton of greenhouse gas emissions. That figure, which could double the level set by Obama, will inform government spending, requiring the rejection of some programs in which the climate costs outweigh economic benefits. The output of good economic policy is good climate outcomes, says Zaidi. In the EU, top officials recount awakening to the need to embrace climate change as a development framework while they prepared for the 2015 climate negotiations that delivered the Paris Agreement. As the European Commission, the bloc's executive body, searched for a path to eliminate the EU's carbon emissions, officials convened a process in which each country dug into its own emissions. They concluded that to cut emissions on the scale required meant incorporating climate across all facets of government. It permeated down from the top governmental level to all other departments, to the societies, to the industrial stakeholders, says Mauro Sefcovic, a vice president of the European Commission who ran the process. 5 years later, the COVID-19 pandemic has given the EU the perfect opportunity to accelerate the remaking of its economic agenda with climate at its core. What Sefcovic calls the new economy of the 21st century, the European Commission framed its pandemic relief program around a so-called Green Deal that aims to invest hundreds of billions of euros in everything from zero-emission trains to growing renewable energy capacity. But its true aims are more ambitious than any line item. If you want to succeed, you have to successfully transform all sectors, says Jeppe Kofod, Denmark's foreign minister. I call it a climate union. A successful centering of climate would place the EU at the center of the global economy, setting standards for the world. Still, the climatization path is not universal progress. Countries can simultaneously invest in a clean economy and continue to prop up polluting industries. In China, the world's largest emitter and second largest economy, officials have made the transition away from high-carbon industries central to development, spending hundreds of billions of dollars to build manufacturing capacity for electric vehicles, solar panels, and other clean energy technology. Recently, it's focused on growing services and the internet economy, rather than a carbon-heavy industry. Still, the country continues to finance fossil fuel development abroad, potentially leaving debtor countries stuck with coal plants and oil pipelines. These differing approaches to climatization have created a new vector for collaboration as well as conflict. One country's efforts to reduce emissions matter only if the whole world moves. And so as countries prioritize climate change in their own economic planning, pressure's grown to ensure others follow suit. The EU has begun the process of linking its climate and trade agendas with a tax on high-carbon imports, penalizing countries slow to act on climate change. Biden has elevated the issue as a diplomatic priority, Every dialogue we have, we're trying to drive ambition, says John Kerry, Biden's climate envoy and a former U.S. Secretary of State. And many of the multilateral financial institutions that fund economic programs in developing countries have required projects to adapt to new climate realities while addressing other needs. If we're going to bail out a private sector organization or company, they should commit to using those resources in a way that's climate friendly, says Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, head of the World Trade Organization and former Nigerian finance minister. The intertwining of the economy and climate change promises to shape global politics and society for the foreseeable future. This is going to be the topic that dominates everything, says John Podesta, the longtime political operative who served in both the Clinton and Obama administrations. The effects on the natural world that result from climate change are going to be central to both the political conversation and how we organize ourselves as a society for at least the next 30 years. Since World War II, the pursuit of economic growth has driven politics. In democracy, citizens look at their bank accounts as a proxy for quality of life, rewarding politicians in boom times and voting them out when times get tough. In authoritarian countries, slow economies have doomed regimes. Political consultant James Carville, who advised President Bill Clinton, put the dynamic simply before the 1992 election. It's the economy, stupid. People will undoubtedly continue to prioritize their own bottom line, thinking about jobs, investments, and retirement. But as the effects of climate change increasingly shape economic outcomes, we may soon be saying, it's the climate, stupid. There are two more photos here. First, an offshore wind farm near Shanghai. We see little triangular-shaped objects. I thought maybe they were in a snowfield. There are 5, 10, 12 of them. And they're not really closed triangles, but each has three prongs atop a tall post. And those are the large windmills that are apparently planted in the ocean near Shanghai. The other is a massive grid formation, large highway arteries intersect at right angles, so you see top to bottom and left to right, and within them is a dense populated area. It's all filled in with browns and grays and probably buildings and concrete, and that is the urban sprawl of Los Angeles. Now I'm going to skip ahead to the final paragraph of this lengthy article, which I am nevertheless abridging. Many who oppose climate policy would undoubtedly take issue with the notion that climate should be addressed in all elements of our society and economy. Back in D.C., McCarthy and Zaidi tread carefully when asked about the costs of climate change, which both note are piling up, before shifting the conversation to a more positive vision. That's why so many people are getting interested in the issue of climate change, says McCarthy, because it's now being presented as an opportunity. It's now being presented as a hopeful message. Two things can be true at once, and the future brought about by climatization may very well include elements of both visions, crushing economic effects as well as opportunities for rejuvenation. Indeed, as the effects of climate change become more apparent, and the response becomes more urgent, it is almost inevitable. But both must be considered. Only by recognizing how climate will seep into everything can we tilt the scale toward towards something a little better. This is with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Alejandro de la Garza of New York, in addition to the lead writer, Justin Warland. Under Nation, the new recruits. Law enforcement agencies are struggling to get people of color to join police forces. So one HBCU launched its own academy. When Tyrese Davis got accepted into Lincoln University's Police Academy, the first of its kind at a historically black college or university, his instinct was to keep it a secret. Davis, 22, prides himself on being the first man in his family to go to college, so the acceptance on January 6 was monumental. It meant he was one step closer to building a future for himself amid the economic tumult of the pandemic. But it came after months of civil unrest following the death of George Floyd in police custody, and on the very day insurrectionists stormed the U.S. Capitol, where police would turn out to have been on both sides of the law. As a black man from Baltimore, where anger remains raw over Freddie Gray's 2015 death while under arrest, Davis worried about backlash from his community. "I did not want to let it be known that I was joining a law enforcement academy," he says. "I did not want to be frowned upon." So January 19, when the academy opened in Jefferson City, Missouri, where Davis lives on campus, he did not share the news with his hometown friends, even though he was making history as part of the first police class at an HBCU. But more than a week later, when he learned that authorities in Rochester, New York, had handcuffed and pepper-sprayed a 9-year-old black girl, the latest in a string of high-profile use-of-force incidents, Davis got fed up with hiding his dreams from friends and began posting photos of himself on Facebook wearing body armor and training at the gun range. HBCU has been mentioned twice already in this article without stating what it is. If I correctly recall, the acronym refers to historically black colleges and universities. Now back to the text, it is my career, not their career, he says. I want them to realize that I'm going to make a change. That is what we need right now. Research suggests he is right. Throughout history, police forces in the U.S. have been predominantly white and male. In 2016, the most recent year for which data are available, about 72% of local police officers were white, and nearly 88% were male, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, BJS. About 64% were both white and male, and about 11% were black, a profile largely unchanged since 1997. A study published in February in the journal Science found Hispanic and black officers use force less frequently than white officers, especially against black people. Evidence that diversity can improve police treatment of communities of color. But nearly a year into the uprising against police brutality and systemic racism, when a traffic stop can still so quickly turn deadly for black Americans like Daunte Wright, it is harder than ever for police departments to recruit and retain officers, particularly those of color. Nationwide, fewer people are applying for the job, and more experienced cops are retiring or quitting in droves, threatening public safety as major cities witness crime spikes. "People are just resigning because they've had enough," says West Lafayette Police Chief Troy Harris in Indiana. "There's a cloud over law enforcement." Harris's department, which serves some 86,000 people, saw a 75% drop in applications from July to December 2020 and had six officers retire or walk off the 50-member force last year. Of the 37 applicants that year, only one was black, according to the chief. If we cannot keep up, it will be a burden and a significant problem, says Harris, who worries he will have to reassign community outreach officers to fill patrol shifts. In Aurora, Colorado, where 23-year-old Elijah McClain died after police held the unarmed black man in a chokehold, at least 87 people resigned, retired, or were fired from the police department in 2020, compared with 54 the year before, according to the agency. 20 more employees left the force in the first 40 days of 2021 alone, nearing the number for all of 2015, just as the city's experiencing a significant increase in major violent crimes, including assaults and robberies. There's no pretty picture down the road, says Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanueva. The sheriff says homicides and or assaults are going through the roof, but his agency is probably the most understaffed in the nation, with less than one deputy for every 1,000 residents. It's pretty grim, Villanueva says. From 2013 to 2016, the number of full-time sworn officers in the U.S. dropped from roughly 725,000 to 701,000, according to the BJS. About 63% of police leaders surveyed by the Police Executive Research Forum, PERF, in 2019 reported a decrease in the number of people applying for police officer positions over the past 5 years. In that time frame, 41% said their officer shortage has worsened. Job applications have plummeted, about 50% in Seattle and 70% in Jefferson County, Colorado, the PERF survey found. All that was before Floyd's death put police at the center of the largest sustained social justice mobilization in modern U.S. history. The sense of crisis was compounded by the Capitol breach. At least 39 members of U.S. law enforcement agencies from 17 states were found to have attended the rally, according to The Appeal, a news and analysis site. One of them was reportedly a top recruiter for the Kentucky State Police. Among the Capitol Police officers, at least six have been suspended with pay, and 29 others are being investigated for their actions, officials said. And although law enforcement is one of the few remaining portals to the middle class that does not require a college degree, the thousands of dollars charged by some police academies can be an obstacle, especially with no guarantee of a job. Davis was fortunate to gain support from his family when he applied to Lincoln, but their warnings are in the back of his mind. My mom always tells me, you are entering a Caucasian world, and she just wants me to be careful, he says. Davis is one of eight black students, two of them women, in the academy's inaugural class of 11 students. One of the white students is Christopher Cade, a 37-year-old state parole officer who signed up for the $6,000 course after seeing so many demoralized cops leaving the profession. No one wants to do the job anymore, he says. It made Cade, a military veteran, want to fill their shoes. I enjoy doing the right thing when nobody's looking, he says. Not many people are willing to do that. Lincoln University Police Chief Gary Hill hoped to attract students with that mentality and drive when he dreamed up the academy about 3 years ago while working at the Cole County Sheriff's Department in Jefferson City. There he came across interns from Lincoln University, his alma mater, who were eager to find an inclusive place to learn about policing. I thought Lincoln has the resources, it has the students, the facilities. It would just be a great idea, says Hill, who left the Sheriff's Department to lead Lincoln's police force in 2016. Now, stopping here for a photograph. It's large. It's in color, but we see mostly blue because it is Tyrese Davis and another individual slightly blurred in the background who are members of the inaugural class of the Lincoln University Academy, the first police training facility at an HBCU. Davis is a person of color. He's wearing a blue golf shirt with LU, probably for Lincoln University, Law Enforcement Training Academy, written on the left shoulder area. He and the other individual next to him, slightly to the background, are wearing black helmets with clear face guards and also some kind of a chin protector. I'm calling it a chin protector. It may actually be the mask required because of the pandemic that has slipped a little bit further down onto his chin. Returning to the text. During the pandemic, nearly 75% of law enforcement agencies altered recruitment and hiring practices, including canceling or adjusting polygraphs and physical fitness assessments, according to a separate PERF survey of more than 140 agencies. In some cases, the changes succeeded in drawing applications. The Naperville Police Department in Illinois, which eliminated its $45 application fee in order to appeal to low-income recruits, saw applications double at the peak of protests over Floyd's death. More than 850 hopefuls applied to join the force throughout the summer, according to Naperville Police Chief Robert Marshall. Of the 455 applicants who moved on to take a written exam, 34 were black men and women, more than double the number in the previous round of recruits in 2018. Jason Aris, the department's deputy chief, believes the applicants felt a call to action, similar to what prompted him to leave his corporate career to become a police officer 6 days after the terrorist attack September 11, 2001. It is still a very noble profession, Aris says. That's A-R-R-E-S. But unlike Naperville's, the overwhelming majority of agencies are struggling as more cops hired during departmental expansions in the 1980s and 90s reach retirement age. Traditional sources of new recruits, including the military and family members of current officers, are no longer filling the gap. And today's applicants, police chiefs say, are less inclined to work holidays, weekends, and nights, or commit to a job that is getting harder and more dangerous. They want to live normally, says Benjamin Bliven, police chief in Wausau, Wisconsin. We're human beings. Police work is hard. Officers spend a great deal of their day dealing with social problems, including homelessness, mental illness, and substance abuse. Intense encounters, their every moves recorded by body cameras or bystanders' phones. In 2020, more than 260 law enforcement officers died in the line of duty, a 96% increase over 2019, and the most since 1974, according to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. More than half the deaths were caused by COVID-19. In 2019, the FBI says 89 officers were killed on duty, including 48 who were gunned down or run over while making arrests, responding to disturbance calls, or conducting investigations and traffic stops. It takes a special person at this point to say, Yeah, I want to do that, says Police Chief J. Darren Stewart in Stonington, Connecticut. I'm again abridging this article and moving to the last column of text, above which is another color photograph. It's Lincoln University Police Chief Gary Hill, another individual of color. He's wearing a khaki slacks, a blue long-sleeved shirt, over which he has a protective vest. He's also wearing protective hand cover. He's got a baseball-type cap on with earphones to protect his ears. The front of the vest also has a sign on it that says Firearms Instructor. And he's facing a line of six, I would say, younger people, both men and women, of diverse ethnicities. They're dressed in gray slacks and more bright blue shirts. Gary Hill is preparing recruits for firearms training at a shooting range in Missouri, March 6. They're standing out in the brush. They're surrounded by brushy undergrowth and trees and shrubs. Since he stopped keeping his career goals a secret, Tyrese Davis has not received as much negativity from his friends as he thought he would. Half the reactions have been supportive, and he's relieved the other half have just been ambivalent. I did not really have to be ashamed of it anymore, he says. He knows the road ahead will not be easy. Davis, who grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood in Baltimore, says he experienced racism for the first time, only in 2017, when he left to attend college in predominantly white Garden City, Kansas. There, he says, he was followed to the checkout line while shopping at Walmart and has been pulled over by the police for allegedly playing music too loudly in his car. It was really a shocker, he says. The experiences left Davis feeling less than human and uncomfortable in his skin. After the events of 2020, he says, he debated whether he still wanted to enter law enforcement. But Floyd's death was the gasoline to my flame. He thinks about all he's accomplished already. Most of his high school friends did not go to college, but in May, Davis is set to graduate from Lincoln, where he's made the dean's list multiple times and plays offensive tackle for the school football team on a scholarship. I broke that recurring cycle, he says. One young man, one young black man, can empower many other ones. Under the heading Society, going it alone. Being single was just a part of their lives before the pandemic. Then it became the defining one. By Belinda Luscombe, Luscombe. I'm a toucher and flirter, and I don't care who you are, says Maggie Duckworth. I will talk to a log. Before the arrival of COVID-19, Duckworth had a pretty sweet life. An events coordinator for a waste management company in Chattanooga, Tennessee, she traveled frequently for work and for fun. She had a large group of friends, a loving family she could visit in Atlanta, and a cool apartment all to herself. In December 2019, Duckworth, 43, was on a date when she snapped her Achilles heel. She was told to keep off her foot and had to be confined to her home while it healed. Just as she was ready to go out again, the pandemic hit. However long the stay-at-home restrictions have been for you, they've been about 4 months longer for Duckworth. The torn tendon was painful, but people could still visit. The isolation of the pandemic was worse. I was not having any interactions with people. I was not touching anyone. I wasn't getting to tell my funny stories, she says wistfully. I did not have anyone to hug or even high-five for months. Duckworth clearly remembers her last embrace before social distancing measures were put in place. Finally able to walk with a cane, she went out for drinks with two friends. and they all went back to her place. We hugged, and we were like, okay, we'll hug in a year, she says. We knew that was the last great night out. In May, Duckworth was laid off. She does not blame her employer. Who needs an events coordinator when there are no events, she says. But that intensified her isolation. She was popular at work and had run the women's group. If someone wrote me and said they were struggling, I could send them flowers, she said. It gave me this really great community. She occasionally went for socially distant walks with a neighbor or sat on someone's porch for drinks. Nevertheless, she lay awake at night worrying about her rent and her health. She began to feel an old adversary, depression, creeping up on her. When a therapist's office told her its earliest appointment was several weeks away, she burst into tears. The office called back as soon as it had a cancellation. For the first time in her life, she filled a prescription for antidepressant medication. At the dawn of 2020, about a quarter of American households were made up of people who lived alone. According to the U.S. Census, the number of households consisting of only one person has jumped 10% in the past 20 years to an all-time high of 28.4% in 2019. Partly this is because people are marrying later in life. The average age of first marriage is nearing 30. And partly sociologists believe it has to do with money. Wealthy countries generally have a higher proportion of people who can afford to live solo. At the same time, many people do not want to get married and raise families until they feel financially secure. In 2017, 14% of Americans told Pew Research they had no interest in getting married. While there's still pressure to pair up, the notion of the sad, unpartnered soul has largely been banished. Single people are no longer denied such societal goodies as a full social calendar, an active sex life, or a home of their own. They can take spontaneous trips, volunteer, indulge in their hobbies, and go on as many dates as they feel up for. They can hang out on short notice with work buddies, neighborhood buddies, college buddies, or extended family. They can spend their money and time as they wish. They can be there for friends who need them in a way those with families cannot. The pandemic changed all that. It amped up the things that are lonely and stressful about being single and muffled the fun stuff. Mathematician philosopher Blaise Pascal was exaggerating when he wrote in 1654 that all of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. Either that or he did not predict Netflix. But even with the Internet's distractions, many single people have had more solitude in the past year than they know what to do with. As the months passed, what was once a feature of their lives became the dominant force. While those with kids and jobs have been run off their feet, and those with spouses have been forced to plumb the depths of their patience and their conversational well, those who do not live with anyone tell time they have had a reckoning with themselves, their choices, and the direction of their lives. We spoke to five of the more than 35 million Americans who live alone, in their 20s to their 50s, in the fall and again in the spring. Some have moved, many have started therapy or taking medication. Some have recommitted to finding a companion, prioritizing their social lives, or strengthening bonds with family. While being single is not a uniform experience, their stories share several themes. Being single is quite different from being alone. There may be a limit to the utility of a fully remote workforce. And so, as sophisticated a species as we humans are, we remain an animal that prefers to herd. there is a really abrupt moment when the Zoom call ends and you go from this feeling of, oh, it's me and six people hanging out, and then it's completely silent in the apartment, says Erin Tye, T-Y-E, 30, of her pandemic social gatherings. There isn't even the train ride home with music to transition between those mental states. 10 months before the pandemic struck, Ty moved out of the place she shared with her ex-boyfriend to one of her own. She had given herself some time off from dating and enjoyed it. Girls' dinners, happy hours, birthday parties, impulsive nights out. She was going to restart the engines at the end of February, which, it turns out, she says, laughing, was just before the pandemic hit. In those early days, single and non-single folks alike turned to creative pursuits to fill the time. But for those with partners or families, the activities usually had a social dimension. Ty took to baking, but was often left with a whole cake to herself. Cooking is an act of service, an act of love, she says. I stopped because I felt like I'm just doing this for me. It kind of sucks. She has not baked in months. Others, too, reported a spike in creativity that faded. Duckworth wrote 15-page letters to friends and practiced her ukulele. William Theriac, who had recently moved to Minnesota and had not quite found his social scene, perfected a 25-ingredient borscht and kulabiaka, a Russian fish pie. Joel Prichow, newly separated from his wife, wrote stand-up comedy. One of his gags was about how there had been so little time to make friends between his separation and the pandemic that it would have been nice if she decided to leave a little sooner. There are a couple of photographs here. Maggie Duckworth has been mentioned. And these are little thumbnail-type photographs, but they're in color. Maggie Duckworth is wearing a V-neck shirt in black, and she has fairly pale skin, and she's wearing really bright red lipstick, and she has short, bright red hair. Think Lucille Ball. Then the next little inset photo is of William Theriac, who perfected, what did he do? The borscht, 25-ingredient borscht. Well, he's a man who's nearly bald, wearing glasses, has some facial hair, and his nose is being smushed by a gray cat who's got his or her head bumping William Theriac's forehead. Some found ways to artificially delineate their work and home lives. Lucy Anguiano, 54, a marketing promotions manager for a media company and a lifelong workaholic who partly attributes her singleness to her love of her job, had formerly observed a strict labor demarcation between her Manhattan Beach, California apartment and her L.A. office. I actually never brought my laptop home, she says. I would work late, and I would not leave the office till everything was done to my satisfaction. I always felt my home was sacred. After her office closed, she says, it felt like a violation of my life that when I walk in, the first thing you see is the big computer. She decided to keep her office confined to the dining room table. Anguiano, Ty, and Duckworth all had friends and family whom they could call upon any time. And they made the most of the social options they had. Ty celebrated her 30th birthday with a picnic instead of the big bash she had planned. She signed up with a wine club and Zoomed a lot. Anguiano joined a Saturday night online movie and wine group. And on Valentine's Day, hand-delivered goodie baskets to her fellow members' doors with a card that thanked them for being my date every Saturday. But seeking companionship can require an admission of vulnerability that not everybody, even the recently separated, is prepared to make. I'm 45. All my friends are married and they have kids, says Prichow. It is not easy to say to someone, hey, I'm alone on Tuesday night and I really don't want to be. Can somebody come over and hang out with me for a couple hours? None of the single people blame their married friends for not checking in on them more. They have sympathy for the grind of homeschooling or never seeing anyone but your partner. My married friends with kids are saying, yeah, my wife and kids are driving me nuts. You're so lucky you just get to sit there and play video games, says Pritchot. And I'm like, hey, at least you got people to talk to. For Teriak, 26, an IT project manager at a construction company, anxiety would hit him, and he couldn't tell why. I'm not behind on anything. I'm not worried about anything, he says. And then I'm like, oh, it's because I don't have any social plans. Teriak moved to Minneapolis just a few months before George Floyd was killed. He was unemployed at the time, so he would check the news often, which added to his stress. He tried to grab some sleep during the day because the helicopters and popping tear gas canisters kept him awake at night. I feel like emotionally I'm dealing with three or four national crises at once, and that's just too much to do alone, he says. His mother stayed with him at various times, but there wasn't enough privacy. As friends moved away, I realized I'm nobody's number one priority, says Teriak. It was that moment where it just got super intense, and I was like, this is extraordinarily lonely. Just before Christmas, Teriak took a risk and moved in with a person he'd never met. Duckworth went back to her parents' house in Atlanta after her lease ran out. It has been better than she feared. She has a car. She formed a quarantine bubble with her nephew, sister, and brother-in-law. Recently, her father had to be hospitalized, and the family told her they would never have managed without her. That article was slightly abridged. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Call us if you have comments or questions at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.